This program is intended for a print-impaired audience and is brought to you by Audio Journal. Welcome to Science Journal, an audio journal production presenting articles of interest from science magazines, newspapers, and online resources on topics such as technology, health, and the environment. This program is supported in part by Cognex and UMass Medical School. I'm Kaushik Satish Kumar, and let's start off this podcast with a quick trivia question. Which of the following planets in our solar system could float in water if there is an ocean large enough? Is it A, Earth, B, Mars, C, Saturn, or D, Jupiter? Keep guessing. I'll reveal the answer at the end of this segment. Now, let's start off our podcast with some coffee. The secret to perfect espresso? It's physics. This article was written by Taylor Mitchell Brown and was published in the April 2026 edition of the Science News Journal. The secret to perfect espresso? It's physics. The key is tight control of the interaction between water and coffee grounds. A memorable shot of espresso is less about roast and more about percolation. And now there is an equation to back that up. The physics explaining how gases bubble through volcanoes, or how water and oils flow through Earth's crust, can also help quantify the perfect percolation of hot water through ground coffee, researchers report in the April 1 Royal Society Open Science. I mostly work on volcanic eruptions, says Fabian Wadsworth, an earth scientist at Ludwig Maximilianus Universität München at Germany. He first became interested in the physics of making espresso as a pedagogical tool to teach students fundamental concepts of percolation. Coffee felt like a natural way that students might get engaged with those problems, he says. Espresso begins with ground coffee beans, which get tamped, or compressed, into a receptacle to form a compact body called a puck. Hot, pressurized water then extracts flavors, bitterness, and caffeine for your morning or afternoon needs. To craft a quality espresso, you need two things, Wadsworth says. The first is to ensure the ground beans are even by removing clumps and tamping the puck uniformly so that you don't have one area of the puck where flow is happening more than another. An even puck ensures the water diffuses throughout all the particles, capturing as much hidden flavor as possible. The second factor, Wadsworth says, is controlling the time it takes for the water to move through the coffee. The more densely packed the puck, the longer water stays in contact with the particle. Too much contact will result in a bitter brew, while too little won't extract enough flavor or caffeine. In the equation, the researchers start with the premise that the grounds are evenly distributed and tamped with equal pressure across the puck. Once you've achieved evenness, you can use our model to calculate the speed of the flow, Wadsworth says. To verify the equation, Wadsworth and his colleagues scrutinized two coffee roasts, Tumba from Rwanda and Guayacan from Colombia, ground at 11 settings each, totaling 22 samples. With software that turns multiple X-ray cross-sections into 3D renderings, they charted how fluid moved through the samples. The results suggest the espresso equation works just as clearly to describe percolation through grounds as other equations describe gas moving through magma or water through sandstone. The results help show how factors such as grain size can significantly impact taste through permeability. If we were to double the grain size, you increase the permeability by a factor of 4, Wadsworth says. Harnessing insights from volcanology for coffee research is genuinely exciting and shows how methods developed in one field can open new perspectives in another, says coffee science experts Samuel Smirk of the Zurich University of Applied Sciences, who is not involved in the work. The model will make the most sense to expert baristas with machines equipped to measure pressure and flow rates, Wadsworth says. They might have a different language for talking about it, but I think they would be able to understand what we did and appreciate it. That concludes our first article. Now we turn to quantum physics. Our next article is titled, Quantum Physics Can Confirm Where Someone Is Located. This article was written by Emily Conover and was published in the March 2026 edition of the Science News Journal. Quantum physics can confirm where someone is located. Entanglement can connect the digital world to the physical world. An urgent call comes in from the White House. But the recipient is skeptical. They need a way to verify that the message comes from the purported location. Quantum physics has a solution. Scientists have demonstrated a quantum technique to ensure that someone is in the location they claim to be, physicist Abigail Gookin reported March 18th at the American Physical Society's Global Physics Summit. Called quantum position verification, the technique is based on the concept of quantum entanglement, in which the fates of two far-flung particles are closely linked. In the future, the technique could be useful for preventing some types of phishing attacks or for limiting which users can access certain resources. For example, access to sensitive nuclear weapons infrastructure could be restricted to those in a secure government building. The method could be part of a future quantum internet that could one day provide various types of ultra-secure communications. Here's how it works. Two people called verifiers each want to confirm that a third person called a prover is in a given location. The verifiers, who are on opposite sides of the prover's purported location, each send a random number to the prover, which the prover will use to determine their next step. Meanwhile, one of the verifiers creates a pair of entangled photons, or particles of light. The verifier holds onto one photon and sends the other to the prover. The prover and verifier measure their photons simultaneously. Specifically, they measure polarization, the direction in which the electromagnetic waves of the photons wiggle. The random numbers tell the prover what measurement settings to use to determine their photon's polarization. The prover sends that result of their measurement back to the verifiers. Then, the verifiers compare the prover's result to the result from the measurement of the other photon. Over many repetitions of this photon measuring protocol, the results should be strongly linked or correlated. If a sneaky imposter intercepted the photon from another location, the results of the measurements wouldn't be as strongly correlated as expected, thanks to constraints set by the speed of light and quirks of quantum measurements. The verifiers would know that something was fishy. At the National Institute of Science and Technology, or NIST, in Boulder, Colorado, scientists created two verifier stations, separated by about 200 meters and connected by optical fibers to a prover in between. The method successfully localized the prover, Gookin, of NIST, and colleagues reported in a paper submitted January 23rd to arcsiv.org. The basis for the technique is what's called a loophole-free Bell test, a method of sending and measuring quantum particles that proves that the oddities of quantum physics can't be explained away. That's because the correlations between pairs of photons are stronger than any classical theory could account for. Because the technique connects a real physical place to information the parties exchange, it could be the basis for other secure communication techniques going forward, says Gookin. This is the first time we can concretely tie someone's location to their information. That concludes the second article. Now, let's explore the depths of the ocean with our third article, titled, A Real-Life Kraken Stalked the Seas of the Late Cretaceous. This article was written by Ari Daniel and was published in the April 2026 edition of the NPR magazine. A real-life kraken stalked the seas of the late Cretaceous. 100 million years ago, during the late Cretaceous period, the oceans were filled with giant predators prowling for their next meal. There was the mosasaur, a giant toothy marine reptile and a surprise hero in Jurassic World. There were large sharks. And now, in the journal Science, researchers present evidence for an ancient colossal octopuses, what they believe are the largest invertebrates ever described. Using innovative fossil reconstruction techniques, the researchers revealed remnants of two extinct species locked inside large rocks. They appear to have been up to 60 feet long, longer than a school bus, rivaling other apex predators of the time, and calling to mind the Kraken of legend. I wasn't expecting any octopus of this magnitude at all, says Fernando Angel Fernandez Alvarez, a zoologist at the Spanish Institute of Oceanography who wasn't involved in the study. And we now have proof that they were living in the past. The findings also reveal that these squishy leviathans likely feasted on crunchy prey items, think shrimp and lobster, and favored one side of their jaw over the other. I always thought that octopuses were extraordinary animals, said Yashiro Iba, a paleontologist at Hokkaido University and lead author on the new publication. But this study made me feel even more strongly that their uniqueness has deep evolutionary roots. Jaws encased in ancient rocks. The findings are all the more remarkable because octopuses don't tend to preserve well. Fossils usually form from bones and other hard materials. So a creature like an octopus, which is made up of almost entirely soft tissue, has been harder to come by in the fossil record. There are very few, very rare records about the octopus and their evolution, says Jörg Mutterlus, a paleontologist at Ruhr University Bochum in Germany and one of the researchers. This has limited our understanding of the development of these creatures and their habitats across time. But more than a decade ago, Iba approached Mutterlus with an idea. He wanted to examine the fossilized contents of big rocks called concretions that had formed on the seafloor some 100 million years ago in what's now northern Japan. We thought there was a real possibility that octopus remains might also be hidden inside them, says Iba. even if nothing was visible from the outside. So he approached Mortaluz, and they worked together, using a new technique that they call digital fossil mining. They cut the concretions into thin slices, took pictures of any preserved fossils, and then created 3D reconstructions, a process facilitated by an AI model. And there, locked inside, were octopus jaws, which is very similar to the beak of a bird, says Mortaluz. They consist of a lower jar, which is like a shovel, and an upper jar. Octopus jars are hard, so they can fossilize. And the animals use them like we do, to chomp down on food. The jaws aren't big enough to swallow a large animal, says Mortaluz, so the ancient octopuses would have used their long, strong arms to catch prey and tear it apart into pieces. A majestic view. The lower jaws were the biggest ones ever found for an octopus, and they offered a window into the lives of these animals. Considering work done in other species, Mortaluz says, archaeologists reconstruct quite a lot about the evolutionary history based on the size and form of teeth. To that end, he and his colleagues used the jaws to estimate the body size of the octopuses. And that's when their calculations reveal that these animals were probably gargantuan, well larger than the giant Pacific octopus, today's biggest member of the family, whose arm span often exceeds 13 feet. Closer inspection of the specimens revealed numerous chips and scratches. Obviously, something happened to the jaws, observes Mortaluz. That something was likely the consumption of prey with hard exoskeletons, including shrimps, bivalves, lobsters, and nautilus-like animals that would have worn away the jaw as they were crushed and eaten, leaving the marks behind. These were active carnivores, and the researchers say they may have been even hunted other large predators, but this remains speculative. In addition, the right side of the jaws tended to be more worn down than the left side. Single-sided usage might indicate that the brain was already fairly well-developed, suggests Mortaluz. This means that these early octopuses may have already been displaying the advanced intelligence that they are known for today. Modern octopuses are intelligent, flexible, and very unusual predators, says Iba. Our results suggest that some of those remarkable traits may already have been emerging in early octopuses during the Cretaceous. One can discern quite a lot from a few key specimens, says Mortaluz. Just a few fossil findings may shed very new light about the evolution of the biosphere, he says. Fernandez Alvarez says the results paint a vivid picture of the ocean ecosystem of the late Cretaceous, one that would have been filled with a myriad of large and hungry predators. It must have been, he says, a very majestic view. That concludes the third article. Our next article is titled, Self-Aware Robots Can Learn Complex Tasks by Watching Humans. Is that a good thing? This article was written by Katie Riddle and was published in the April 2026 edition of NPR magazine. Self-aware robots can learn complex tasks by watching humans. Is that a good thing? Imagine a robot that could do your laundry, make your bed, cook your dinner, or stock the dairy section at your local grocery store. Humans have long been able to teach robots how to do individual tasks, but instructing them on these more sophisticated jobs has been an elusive goal, despite billions of dollars invested into robotics. Now, A team of scientists in Switzerland has made progress in the quest to invent helpful humans that can act on complex instruction from humans. The development raises questions about whether this kind of technology could someday learn not only to help humans, but also become capable of harming them. Inventing the personal barista. For years, robotic scientist Shritya Gupta has been dreaming about the things his robot might do. "I personally want the robot to make me a coffee," says Gupta. He and his colleagues at École Polytechnique Fédérale de Lausanne, an engineering school in Switzerland, keep late hours at their lab in the Swiss Alps. "There's a lot of coffee consumption," says Gupta. "If I could just say a little bit of sugar, a little more creamer, stuff like that," he says, "that would be a dream come true." A problem that robotic scientists and engineers alike Gupta have long battled is that robots cannot do tasks beyond those they're specifically programmed for. Gupta uses a tennis example to explain the issue. "Robots may be able to learn how to hit a backhand shot," he explains. "They can backhand that ball perfectly again and again and again. But if conditions change, say their opponent moves or the light changes, it all falls apart. Humans have no problem adjusting to these kinds of changes. Teaching a robot how to adapt, though, is much more difficult. It's very difficult to transfer this behavior from humans to robots," says Gupta. "Until now," he hopes. Gupta and his colleagues published a paper in the journal Science Robotics demonstrating a new way of teaching robots using machine learning, a type of artificial intelligence. Their approach relies on kinematic intelligence, a robot's built-in awareness of how its own body can move safely through space. In a video demonstrating their technology, robots with a single arm attached to a base watch as a human instructor tosses a ball into a small container. The robots then pick up the ball and copy the instructor's behavior, adjusting for their own position and accommodating their non-human bodies. Robots are then capable of transferring these skills and knowledge to other robots. "It could be a turning point," says Robert Platt, who studies engineering and robotics at Northeastern University. Platt, who called the work a breakthrough, noted that the field of robotics is not in widespread agreement about the path forward to creating effective robots through machine learning. "Most people may do this in the future," he said. Platt was hesitant to focus on any particular timeline for robots becoming widespread household accessories. "We're at a point of very fast change," he notes. "Part of the reason why I hesitate to make predictions, look what happened with large language models," he says, referring to generative AI chatbots such as ChatGPT or Claude that have been widely adopted. "We were a long way away, and then all of a sudden, we weren't." A fine line between self-awareness and consciousness. If a robot can self-correct and teach others, does that make it self-aware? It looks like this robot is capable of doing some very impressive feats of learning, says Susan Schneider, who studies artificial intelligence at Florida Atlantic University. But that doesn't mean something has full-blown consciousness or inner awareness in the sense that biological beings have it. Schneider points out that a critical distinction between robots and humans is feeling. "Consciousness is the felt quality of experience," she says. "When you sip your morning espresso shot, when you see the richness of the sunset, When you have a headache, it feels like something from the inside to be you. But this lack of consciousness poses new questions about ethics. It immediately raises alarm bells in any AI safety researcher's mind, says Schneider. Later versions of this kind of technology, she says, could potentially be weaponized against humans. Researchers have taken care to include safety protocols to ensure that robots aren't able to hurt people. Even they acknowledge, however, that future development of this technology will need guardrails. I think really soon we should have regulatory frameworks on who operates a robot and how, says Gupta. Humans aren't at an inflection point with robotics, says Susan Schneider. It's a very exciting time, she says, and we just don't know where it's headed. That concludes the fourth article. Our next article is titled Cosmic Illusions. The article was written by Daniel Clary and was published in the April 2026 edition of the Science magazine. Cosmic Illusions. Reappearing flashes from deep space, lensed by gravity, could resolve a dispute over the speed of the expanding universe. Sherry Suyu can't wait for the sun to get out of the way. Sometime after June, when Earth's turn around the sun brings a distant galaxy into view, she expects to see a giant star explode at the end of its life. Supernova usually don't send out invitations in advance. But this one, called SN Requiem, has already gone off three times before. Suyu, a cosmologist at the Max Planck Institute for Astrophysics, predicts it will detonate again, as if the star is refusing to stay dead. It's an illusion. The star exploded just once, but its death is replayed through the magic of gravitational lensing. A huge cluster of galaxies sits between the shattered star and Earth, and its potent gravity is bending the supernova's light, forcing it to draw different paths with different travel times. As a result, the flash of the explosion appears differently, at different locations and times. The lens produced three bursts of light in 2016. After precisely mapping the mass in the galaxy cluster, Suyu and her colleagues calculated it would also steer light along a longer path, with a fourth reappearance coming sometime in the next year or two. We made our predictions, we published them, Suyu says. Now we'll just wait. Starting in June, they will check on SN Requiem's galaxy once a month with the Hubble Space Telescope. If he spots anything, they will enlist the sharp vision of JWST, NASA's infrared observatory. They hope to watch the light show unfold in real time, and not only to confirm their prediction. By clocking the time delay, they can accurately measure the galaxy's distance. And by combining its distance with how quickly it is receding from Earth, indicated by the redshift of this light, they will get a reading of the Hubble constant, the expansion rate of the universe. The Hubble constant is a key measure of a universe in which everything is flying apart, floating on a sea of expanding space. It is the number that implies the universe was born in a Big Bang, and its reciprocal gives the age of the universe, about 13.8 billion years. It is also the subject of a fierce dispute. The two main approaches to measuring the Hubble constant deliver different answers, and researchers have been locked into an impasse for more than a decade. We really need something more, like a third way to measure the Hubble constant, says cosmologist Eleonora DiValentino of the University of Sheffield. Soyuz Lens Supernova, and the dozens more that powerful new survey telescopes are expected to find, could provide the third way and deliver a decisive verdict. "We're at a really interesting sort of inflection point," says Saul Perlmutter, an astrophysicist at the University of California, Berkeley. "We have all the pieces in place." For nearly a century, ever since Edwin Hubble, in 1929, offered his first assessment, astronomers have calculated the Hubble constant by working outwards from the Milky Way. The easy part is measuring speed, by gauging the distance of an object's light towards the red end of the spectrum. Far more difficult are distances, which require standard candles. Objects and distant galaxies that pulse or flash in a way that reliably encodes how far they are. Astronomers have found enough of these beacons to measure the Hubble constant out to about 1 billion light years, settling on a value of about 73 kilometers per second per megaparsec. 1 parsec is 3.26 light years. More recently, cosmologists have gone after the Hubble constant in the opposite direction, from the edge of the observable universe inwards. They start with a snapshot of the infant universe preserved in the cosmic microwave background, the afterglow of the Big Bang. Ripples in the CMB, created by sound waves coursing through the newborn universe, offer a standard yardstick with which to calculate the Hubble constant at that primordial moment. To adjust that value for the present day, however, two other factors must be accounted for. One is dark matter, the as-yet unidentified stuff whose gravity slows down the outward spread of the galaxies. The other is dark energy, a repulsive force that is accelerating the expansion of space itself. Baking in those assumptions, the cosmologists say the Hubble constant should now be about 67. Both results have been calculated to a precision of around 1%, leaving a yawning gap known as the Hubble tension. If the cosmologists are right, some systemic bias, an unknown unknown, must be skewing astronomers' traditional distance measurements. But if the astronomers are right, the problem could lie deeper. In cosmologists' standard picture of the universe, resolving the Hubble tension in favor of the astronomers would suggest that cosmologists' understanding of dark matter and dark energy is incomplete. DiValentino says, "We are clinging to this model. We don't want to let it go." Suyu and others note that the gravitational lensing method, also known as time delay cosmography, is immune to the many finicky issues that surround standard candles. For instance, stars called CFID variables pulse at a rate that signals their intrinsic brightness, making it possible to infer their distance from their brightness in the sky. But the chemical makeup of each star and the amount of dust surrounding it can skew the pulse-brightness relationship. Another standard candle, so-called Type 1A supernovae, can be seen at much greater distances. They are thought to occur when a new fuel added to a burned-out star reaches a critical threshold, triggering an explosion with a predictable peak brightness. But astronomers keep finding other triggers for the explosions, casting doubt on how uniform they really are. Time delay cosmography, by contrast, does not depend on the astrophysics of pulsing or exploding stars, nor does it make any assumptions about dark matter or dark energy. It relies only on a galaxy or galaxy cluster to act as a gravitational lens, and an object, such as a supernova, whose bright flash provides a timestamp. Astronomers only need to measure the delay between observed flashes and apply simple geometry. The delay gives the difference in path lengths, and the positions of the images on the sky allow astronomers to triangulate, giving an absolute distance to the supernova. The idea goes back to the early 1960s, when gravitational lenses had only been theorized. But Jur Refstahl, a graduate student at the University of Oslo, suggested a way to calculate how such a lens would bend light, using the same geometric tools used to model the paths of light through a glass lens. His thesis evaluators weren't convinced, until he got the result published in the monthly notices of the Royal Astronomical Society in 1964. In the same issue, Refstahl also proposed a way to put his technique to work. He suggested time-delayed images of a lens supernova could offer a handle on the Hubble constant. No one had ever seen a gravitational lens, let alone multiple images of a supernova. But at the end of that second paper, Refstahl wondered whether quasars, strange bright objects that had recently been discovered, might also work. Quasars would soon be recognized as supermassive black holes, shining constantly from the hearts of distant galaxies as they gorge on matter. They sometimes burp on their meals and flare up, generating a spike in brightness that might provide the timestamp astronomers need to look for in lensed images. Today, astronomers have found dozens of lens quasars by spotting their twin images close together in the sky. But using them to calculate the Hubble constant isn't easy, says astrophysicist Tommaso Treu of UCLA. One problem is that quasar light is noisy, making it hard to recognize a specific flare-up when it reappears later in a different image. Waiting for those flickers also requires lots of telescope times, which is not easy to get from busy observatories. In 2002, Treu, then a postdoc at the California Institute of Technology, and a colleague published their first stab at calculating the Hubble constant based on a single-lens quasar. At the time, we were very happy to get the precision to about 20%, he says. A common challenge for both supernova and quasars is working out how mass is distributed in the gravitational lens. Unlike a glass lens, a gravitational lens can be full of clumps and voids that produce images like a funhouse mirror, making it hard to predict how long light will take to wend its way through. And a further complication must be accounted for. According to Albert Einstein's theory of gravity, light slows down as it passes through a strong gravitational field, which can significantly add to the delay. As Treu and others searched for more lensed quasars, they largely focused on those with simpler gravitational lenses, individual galaxies rather than clusters. Astrophysicists have a good understanding of how the mass is distributed in individual galaxies, especially elliptical ones, which are relatively symmetric. By 2010, Treu and his teammates had narrowed the precision down below 7% for another single quasar. Finally, we can go somewhere, he says. To go further, however, they had to find a better way to determine the mass distribution in the lens. The solution has come from instruments known as integral field spectrographs, attached to the world's most powerful telescopes, such as the Keck telescopes in Hawaii, the Very Large Telescope in Chile, and JWST. The instruments divide an image of a galaxy into squares and glean a spectrum for each square, which reveals how fast the stars are moving within it. The greater a galaxy's gravity, the faster stars swirl around it. So the observations improve models of the galaxy's mass and how it's distributed. Various teams working on lens quasars joined together in a collaboration called TD-COSMO. In December 2025, they published their latest result based on 8 lens quasars, with most of the lenses scrutinized by an integral field spectrograph on JWST. The resulting Hubble constant was 71.6, a value between the astronomers and cosmologist camps. The precision improved to 4.6%, not yet good enough to decisively favor a high or low value. True says the collaboration's next effort will include an analysis of up to 12 quasars, which the team calculates will take its precision to between 2 and 3%. Meanwhile, astronomers hoping to find gravitationally lensed supernova the beacons Restall originally suggested have not been idle. In 2014, Patrick Kelly, then a postdoc at the UC Berkeley, was peering at Hubble images of massive galaxy clusters, using them as cosmic magnifying glasses to study distant galaxies. He was looking at a fresh image, taken in November, of one of the clusters when he spotted 4 bright starbursts that hadn't been there before. "It was pretty evident what it was right away," says Kelly, now at the University of Minnesota Twin Cities. Discovered 50 years after Refstall's prediction, this first example of a lens supernova was dubbed SN Refstall. The supernova's host galaxy was lensed into 6 images. Astronomers calculated that there had been an earlier supernova image on top of the 4 2014 discoveries, and that SN Refstall would make a 6th appearance. Observers went into overdrive, Kelly says, gathering data to help model the gravity of the lensing cluster. Some models predicted a reappearance within a year, but Hubble saw nothing in October or November 2015. Suyu, a postdoc at the time, took part in one of the modeling groups. She says she was super nervous because their model predicted with 99.9% confidence that the supernova should reappear before the end of 2015. It turned up right on time in December. "We got an early Christmas present that year," Suyu says. The delay between the first and last observed appearances yielded a Hubble constant value of 64.8, with 5.5% precision. Since then, astronomers have discovered a handful of other lens supernova. Some had very short time delays, which don't produce as precise a Hubble constant value. Others had predicted reappearances that were too far in the future for impatient astronomers. That was initially the case for the 4th reappearance of SN Requiem, which, based on early estimates, wasn't due until 2037. Then came a surprise. In 2023, observers using the JWST found a second supernova, SN Encore, which exploded in the same background galaxy as SN Requiem. With 2 possible gauges of the Hubble constant in the same galaxy, Suyu and collaborators sought to build the best possible mass model of the cluster bending their light. As lenses, clusters are far more powerful than individual galaxies, producing time delays of years and decades instead of days or weeks. But it's much more complicated to model their mass distributions. Each cluster includes tens or hundreds of member galaxies, and each of those has its own halo of dark matter and hot gas that must be accounted for. First, Suyu says, researchers had to figure out the cluster's membership list. They used the Very Large Telescope to get redshifts for each galaxy in the image, identifying more than 80 that had similar redshifts and so probably belonged to the cluster. They estimated each galaxy's mass based on its brightness. Then, they built a mass model and check to see whether it would distort background objects other than the supernova in a way that matched observations. It was an iterative process, says Anna Aceban of the University of Cantabria. We start simple and then add complexity. It's kind of an art, actually. SUYU assembled 7 teams, each working independently to construct its own cluster mass model using different methods. Finally, the models were tested to see how well they reproduced the supernova images. SUYU and his colleagues then recorded an overall model with input from the 7 models weighted according to their performance. The final prediction for SN Requiem's 4th appearance, turned out, was in 10 years' time, not 20. In other words, sometime in the next 2 years. I really think the supernova will appear in those next 2 years. It's just when, SUYU says. The timing will be crucial. If SN Requiem reappears this year, it will lead to a higher value of the Hubble constant and validate the astronomers' camp. If the supernova is not seen until next year, it will lead to a lower Hubble constant value that affirms the cosmologists. SUYU says she's trying to remain neutral. On its own, SUYU says, SN Requiem could offer a precision of 2-3%. But that won't satisfy everyone. She eventually wants to get below 1% precision, the same as the 2 existing methods. Then, she says, we put this to rest once and for all. A clear verdict will require many more lens supernova like SN Requiem. The second lens supernova in SN Requiem's galaxy isn't expected to reappear until the early 2030s. But JWST is starting to turn up many others. Since its 2021 launch, it has spotted more than 10, 8 of them through a program that is carrying out lengthy observations of 60 galaxy clusters for a variety of science goals. These things that we would find maybe once every year or couple of years, we have now found one every 2 weeks over the past 4 months of this program, says Connor Larrison of the Space Telescope Science Institute. JWST's resolution is just so much better for finding these things. A raft of new survey telescopes designed to peer deeply and widely across the heavens could add to the harvest. A European space telescope called Euclid, launched in 2023, will release its first transit data later this year. NASA may launch its Nancy Grace Roman Space Telescope before the end of the year. And the Vera C. Rubin Observatory in Chile will begin a 10-year cosmic survey in the coming weeks. In March, ahead of the start of its formal survey, Rubin in a single night gave astronomers a taste of what's to come. 800,000 alerts to potential transient objects, any one of which could be a lens supernova. We're still learning, SUYU says. This is really a new territory for us. But at the same time, I think it opens a lot of new opportunities. Perlmutter is eager to see what a time-delayed cosmography can finally pin down the expanding universe's key number. Now we have a technique waiting in the wings. And we're about to open the curtain. That concludes the 5th article. Our final article is titled, Can Extinct Volcanoes Still Erupt? A Greek Peak Holds Surprising Clues. The article was written by Skylar Ware and was published in the April 2026 edition of the Science News Journal. Can Extinct Volcanoes Still Erupt? A Greek Peak Holds Surprising Clues. Tiny crystals suggest magma can build underground for thousands of years. For more than 100,000 years, a Greek volcano lay silent. But deep underground, it was still growing. Tiny zircon crystals show magma was quietly brewing between eruptions, researchers report April 22 in Science Advances. The finding suggests that some volcanoes, scientists think, are dead, may not be dead at all. And it could help identify quiet volcanoes that might still erupt in the future. I think we definitely have to start reevaluating how we classify extinct volcanoes, says Rezvan Gabriel Popa, a volcanologist at ETH Zurich in Switzerland. Small volcanoes are usually considered extinct if they haven't erupted in the last 10,000 years or so. Larger volcanoes can go much longer between eruptions because it takes longer to build up enough magma to feed an eruption. Popa and colleagues discovered there can be a lot more going on under the surface when they studied the history of Methana, an active volcano about 50 kilometers from Athens. The team collected volcanic rock samples and searched for zircon because the crystals form in magma chambers deep underground. Eruptions carry the zircon crystals to the surface. By dating crystals in more than 1,250 rock samples, the team put together a 700,000-year timeline of Methana's eruptions. The volcano went through two main periods of eruptions, the first ending around 280,000 years ago, and the second beginning around 168,000 years ago. If the volcano had truly gone silent, the team wouldn't have found any zircon crystals between the two eruptions. Instead, the team found the highest zircon generation during that period of quiescence. This suggests that even if a volcano looks dormant, it might be active deep below. Water-saturated magma may have been responsible for kicking off the long break in eruptions, the team says. As high pressures deep underground, water helps keep magma molten. But as that magma rises and the pressure decreases, the water starts to bubble out. It's like a fizzy drink, Popa says. We open the bottle and all the gas comes out. As water vapor escapes, the magma begins to crystallize and solidify. It eventually becomes so viscous that it can no longer rise, and it stalls before reaching the surface and erupting. This magma behavior could help explain why volcanoes erupt when they do, says Kerry Cooper, a geochemist at the University of California, Davis. Most magmas that enter Earth's crust don't erupt, Cooper says. So if other volcanoes exhibit similar behavior to Methana, it could support the idea that the water content of magma could, in part, determine when a volcano does or does not erupt. Linking magma chemistry to the long-term cycles of volcanic systems could also help researchers forecast volcanic hazards and decide which volcanoes to monitor more closely. Part of that calculation is how recently they have erupted, says Adam Kent, who studies igneous rocks and volcanoes at Oregon State University in Corvallis, but was not involved in the study. In that sense, there are probably volcanoes out there that are threatening, but not evaluated as such because they haven't erupted for a while. That concludes the final article. Now, let's get back to the trivia question from the beginning of the podcast. Which of the following planets in our solar system could float in water if there were an ocean large enough? The answer was C, Saturn. Saturn has an average density lower than water, so it would float if a large enough ocean existed. Even though it's massive, it's made mostly of gases like hydrogen and helium, which keeps its density low.
You have been listening to Science Journal, a production of Audio Journal, a proud member of the Massachusetts Audio Information Network. If you would like a hard copy of our program schedule, either in large print or braille, please call 508-797-1117. Archived editions of this program are available on our website, audiojournal.org, or go to the Audio Journal app on your iPhone, iPad, or Android device. If you have an idea for a topic to explore, please contact Audio Journal at 508-797-1117 or email info@audiojournal.org. I'm Kaushik Satish Kumar, and thank you for listening.
The song of the wood thrush is an ethereal sound of summer in North America. From April to September, these robin-sized songsters serenade deciduous forests of the eastern U.S. and Canada. Each fall, they migrate to rainforests from southern Mexico to Panama, where they call to each other from the underbrush. For wood thrushes, not just any woods will do. They depend on large blocks of intact forest throughout their range. Unfortunately, wood thrushes are losing habitat as humans convert vibrant forests to pastures, mines, and urban developments. As the remaining forests become smaller and scattered, the wood thrush are left with less food and more threats from predators. We can help wood thrushes and forest birds everywhere by conserving and restoring woodlands throughout the Americas. That includes planting native trees in urban green spaces and buying bird-friendly coffee that's cultivated without destroying the crucial habitats that support the wood thrush's priceless song. For Bird Note, I'm Michael Stein. Support comes from Wild Delight Bird Food, offering a variety of blends designed to mimic the natural resources wild birds crave. Available at Chewy.com.
You are listening to Audio Journal, a proud member of the Massachusetts Audio Information Network.
Hi, my name's Owen Devlin, and this is my story. When my doctor told me I was losing my vision, I was devastated. I worried about my future. How would I attend college, find a great job, start a family, or even travel around my own neighborhood? Luckily, my doctor also told me about the Mass Commission for the Blind. They connected me and my family to a counselor who helped us to set a vision for my future, one that included assistive technology to allow me to go to school and find a meaningful job, a white cane to help me navigate, and even tips on how to use Google Maps on my mobile phone. I found out that losing my vision wasn't the end of the world.
If your loved one is blind or visually impaired, find out if they are eligible to register for services. Call 1-800-392-6450 or visit mass.gov/MCB. That's 1-800-392-6450 or visit mass.gov/MCB.
Listen to Audio Journal on your smart speaker. Just say, "Alexa, play radio station Audio Journal on TuneIn," or, "Hey Google, play radio station Audio Journal on TuneIn."